doing? I go. I just said I couldn't read it out loud if I was facing you. Oh, yeah, of course. I lie. The AC clicks itself off again. The Elmer Bernstein continues on a loop from Amir's computer, the same song on repeat, trumpet, trumpet, trumpet. Chapter 1, Amir says, page 1 only. He faux coughs twice and goes, I can't believe I'm doing this. And I go, that's a compelling first line. And he goes, Quinn, and I shut up. Marlik Tabazian, Amir says, his voice small, awakened earlier than she had in months because the heat was eating her from the inside out. This was unusual even for Lindandia, which was carved into the earth 2,000 years after the great Lindandian fall. I hold my breath. His work is possibly terrible. Yes, that's the word, terrible. And so I put my feet against his back so that he feels he has my support. It's amazing how much you can fake physically. Just ask Marlon Brando, who literally couldn't really speak and was the best actor of all time. Marlik's spirit mother, Tasia Tabazian, he continues, getting louder and unfortunately more confident, was already in the study, looking over the day's agenda. She startled at the sight of her spirit daughter, unclothed and floating. Oh dear. I pull my feet away. Even my feet can't fake it in the face of this hokum. But then something changes. Amir's voice gets stronger and softer at the same time, and I am able to hear that his writing is stilted but ambitious, which describes perhaps the opposite of my whole life, articulate but lazy. You can tell he has created a world that he believes in, or wants his readers to. And by the end of page 1, I am able to appreciate the fact that he is attempting something, that he is, at least, not hibernating. Okay, blah, he goes, swinging back around. End of page 1, that's it. Ah, I want to kill myself. Don't say that, it was wonderful. No, it wasn't, he says, but he's not exactly looking away from me. Your turn, he goes, setting the laptop on my legs. Page 1 of your screenplay. No, I say, somehow working a lighthearted laugh into the proceedings. Seriously, no way. Then you're not getting laid, he goes, as if he's punishing me, which he is. We have a staring contest, and damn it, he wins. Trumpets, trumpets, trumpets. I open up a new tab and type in my cloud password and scroll through all my screenplays. And for a moment, I truly do debate reading from double digits. When I open up the first page, I can't help at least smile at how very me it is. But then I read this jokey character description that always made her giggle. The first scene of the screenplay started with me describing the title character as a fierce young warrior, and I don't mean gay fierce. And right here on this sofa, I can hear Annabeth cackling at that turn of phrase and just... No. I am not doing this, Amir, I say, letting my eyes rest on the phrase fierce young warrior. Only my sister got to hear my bad line readings. I look over the laptop screen and Amir is pulling off his mesh shorts. Are you sure you won't even read one page? He says. He is in purple briefs. He is beautiful. He is both a badger and a butterfly. Trumpets, 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 beat, beat, beat. I lick my lips, not to flirt, but to prepare. I close my eyes and count backward from 10, telling myself I'll know by the time I hit 1. But I know by the time I hit 9. I'm just not ready, I say. I look up. The smallest saliva bubble has formed on Amir's lips, and I don't care. His imperfections are his perfections. 10 beautiful fingers creep up over his computer, and when the screen clamps silently shut, the trumpets continue to play for one more moment, as if Elmer Bernstein's little orchestra of tiny people is trapped inside the laptop. Amir is shirtless. His tank top has disappeared. His hat is on the floor. His hair is matted down. He is smiling, but it is a sex smile, not any other kind. I know this instantly because... nobody has ever smiled at me like this. and so it must be that. Well, I still think you're a genius, he says, and I go, careful, if you keep saying that, I might believe you. He takes the laptop and puts it on his coffee table. It is in this moment that I understand that Amir is not a genius himself, at least not at storytelling. I replay the first page of his novel in my mind, and I decide that a future in business might be good for Amir. He is not a genius, and rereading the first page of Double Digits to myself makes me wonder if in some small way I've been comparing myself to the great filmmakers too early in my career. Amir is older than me, but I am a more talented writer, this I know. If he feels confident enough to even try writing the great Iranian-American novel, maybe I shouldn't give up so easily on attempting my own personal, like, great American whatever. How much of your novel did you have to submit before getting accepted into the San Francisco thing? I ask. I can feel my lip twitching. He karate chops a cushion. None of it. What? Evan's brother runs the program, and I got in as a favor, and I never submitted any writing, so can we not talk about this right now? I nod. He pulls me up and grabs the bottom ridge of my shirt, and I feel an air-conditioned coolness on my stomach, and I jut my elbows down and push his hands away. What? He goes, do you not want to do this? His breath smells like breath, not unpleasant, but definitely human. I'm really self-conscious about my body, I say. But he takes my hands and leads me out of the bright-ass living room. He does not have an AC in his bedroom, but then he barely has a bed. A mattress sits on the floor with a paisley sheet thrown across, with boxes surrounding it, with boy clothes piled on a chair. I packed everything up, he goes, and then, is it too hot in here? And I say, no, not at all, because I am freezing as if I have a fever. My riverboat chest has hit an iceberg after all. He pulls my shirt off over my head, and I hunch my shoulders in, and I wish I had my bangs back to brush down into my face. And when he takes off my glasses and then his own, and tries mine on without asking, and goes, wait, are these fakes? I want to yell that everything is, Amir. Everything is fake. He puts his glasses back on and places mine on the mattress. You shouldn't be self-conscious of your body, he says, like, at all. His fingers are tracing the bony tracks of my chest. I am completely hard, only as a reaction to physical touch, but not out of anticipation or even horniness. I'm kind of petrified I will do everything wrong. Evan, the ex, is so much older than I am. They must have had tricks, techniques, and inside jokes, even in the bedroom. God knows I've seen enough porn to at least have a basic sense of the etiquette and approach to this stuff, but then again, I have watched a lot of YouTubes of Olympic divers, too. Those bathing suits. And I am no closer to flipping off a 40-foot platform than I am to winning an Oscar. Hey, Amir says, and he kisses my nose. Distracted boy. I kiss him back, this time with a medium amount of tongue, and we fall onto his mattress, and a streetlight spills into the room through blinds that make Amir look like a beautiful striped zebra, as exotic and endangered as every boy has ever felt to me. I'm so sad, I say, to buy some time, but also to try out what that sounds like. And he goes, aw, about me leaving? And I say, no, sorry, I mean, yes, but I am so sad that my sister and my best friend didn't trust me enough to tell me they were, like, a thing. In all these months, I have never once said I am sad, not out loud. Maybe because it's so obvious that it seems a little on the nose to verbalize. I hate being ordinary. But now that I've said it, it pulses like a blue bug zapper. I am sad. Pulse, 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 zap. Do you want to, like, talk about it? Nah, I say. I just wanted to name it. Okay. Pause. He places his hand on my stomach, dangerously close to boner zone. I still think you're adorable. More making out, I say, sniffing, less talking. And that's the cue to have epic sex, it just is. But then, we don't have even normal sex. Not at all. We talk. We talk about what it's like to be embarrassed about being somebody's kid. And we talk about how strangely coordinated we both were at Little League. And we talk about what we think happens to somebody's, like, soul when they die. Absolutely nothing, we both conclude. And we talk about how weird it is to burn a loved one into a fine powder and then put her into a $15 orange jar, and what it's like to be young but feel old, and why we both want to tell stories and why Pittsburgh is wonderful. We talk about Evan, and we talk about my dad. We talk about how both our balloons got caught on the guardrail of the roof on the night we met. And we talk about how neither of us really believes in signs or coincidences, except the way we say it, I think we're both still holding out hope that perhaps, perhaps. Fully an hour later, we are talking about how Amir is semi-allergic to lactose and about how I am fully allergic to optimism. And though it's my best piece of dialogue all week, neither of us even smiles at it. At some point, I nod off. And at another point, I wake up and he is looking right at me. And I say, I don't think this is going to happen tonight. And he goes, I sort of figured that out an hour ago. And then it's his turn to drift off, as though I am keeping guard of the campsite so he can get a few winks in before the bears return, before life happens again. My mouth is dry because it has said too many words. I put my shirt back on. I walk out to the living room and I'm not exactly proud of this, but I find Amir's laptop and I open the screen. And when there is no password to have to guess at, I would have tried Evan123 and then Evan forever. I hit mute on Elmer Bernstein's violins. And I open Amir's Morning Pages daily diary, and I scroll and I scroll, and I see something shocking and true involving me. I see that in the days since Amir met me, he hasn't written about Quinn Roberts, not even once. He has written only about Evan. But maybe all my years of faking an uptight detective voice for my mom have paid off, because I feel I have solved a true mystery. Amir has always been the younger guy. Finally, with me, he can be older. He can even the score. He is not my prop tonight. I am his. That is all this is or was, not that Amir and I were ever enough of a thing to even be a was. He says. He is somehow standing before me in those purple briefs. I fumble to X out of his Morning Pages Word document, and I say, sorry, just checking my email. And he squinches his face up at me and goes, okay, and bends down to pick up his shorts and his tank top and his hat. And he hands me back my fake glasses. Other than reminding me to buckle up, Amir wordlessly drives me back home. But before I get out, he turns down NPR and goes, The Great Escape. And I say, I'm sorry? And he goes, The Bernstein score at my place, that's what I was playing for you. Oh, right, I say, of course. The Great Escape, good movie. Yeah, he says. The porch lights aren't flashing tonight, and so I give myself the luxury of one more minute and go, trivia. He laughs. Okay, trivia, can't wait. First question, am I a joke to you? What? Sorry, have I just been, like, some anonymous kid to potentially fuck around with just so you could get even with Evan? Amir takes my hand and puts it on his lap. He is completely hard. Does this, he says, feel anonymous to you? And because I am not expecting it at all, because I had completely given up on the idea of losing my virginity tonight, this time I don't write a sex scene, I just have one. He unbuckles himself and reclines his seat, and I mount him as if he is, in fact, that escaped and exotic zebra. I'm fumbling for his zipper, exploring the scar on his stomach, kissing him so hard our teeth clatter, or maybe that's just because I'm freezing cold again. and absolutely shaking. "Do you want me to turn the heat on?" he whispers, like my mom might be hiding in the back seat. And I say, "No, I want you to drive us down the street with your headlights off." I climb off him back into my seat, crossing my legs like a lady at a beauty salon, and touch my swollen lips, which I discover are smiling, which are burning like something alive and rubbed raw by a real live man's face. 2 minutes later, we are parked beneath an ancient weeping willow on an abandoned lot, naked in the backseat of a Mears Saturn, our limbs intertwined like mixed-race pretzels, the moon so overcast that, for one brief, funny moment, I think that if a cop approached the car with a flashlight, we might look like siblings with the same exact color skin and height wrestling. When Amir pulls off one of his socks to clean us up, we laugh. "We kept our socks on," we say at the same time, and then, "Jinx." And he goes, "That doesn't always happen with two people, just FYI, the, finishing at the same time thing." I go, "Cool," pull my lucky boxers back up, and scramble into the front seat, where I look up to see not a lost bird outside Amir's windshield, but instead a black ribbon, tied to the willow tree we'd nearly driven into. And I am not freezing anymore. We kiss one more time, and the way he goes, obviously we're keeping in touch, after the little drive back up to my house, and the way I go, obviously, duh, back to him, makes me understand that I am somehow not at all sad that I'm never going to see him again. Chapter 31. Mom must be in her bedroom because the sunroom light is off. The house feels burglarized somehow, unsettlingly altered by the mere act of cleaning it. I wash a mirror off my hands. There's a silver dollar on the kitchen counter with a post-it note on it. "More loot for my birthday boy," it says. Our house is a strange nighttime pirate cove. Mom's parents left her nothing when they died, and yet now it is as if our old house is bleeding treasure at every turn. I'm walking up the stairs, and each of its steps is behaving tonight. In the humidity, they have stopped crying out and have decided to cooperate. Though I've gotten used to coasting right by Annabeth's room, I've still never gone back in, but tonight I look at the door and I feel it pulsing, pulse, pulse, pulse. Zap. I feel it asking me to enter as if to say, "We are the same now, we are no longer virgins," and so I go in. I open the door and this is it. Her room is the final showdown. I know this instantly. It must be. Her room is the secret monster I haven't met yet. This is the level I must pass. I am Ripley and her room is the alien queen. Aliens. I am Rocky Balboa, and her room is Apollo Creed, Rocky. I am Dirty Harry, and her room is the Scorpio Killer, Dirty Harry. Ever notice that in the old days, they just named the villain or the protagonist right in the title? The title of my movie might just be Quinn, the rare film in which the audience isn't sure at the end if the lead was the good guy or the bad guy. I walk to her bed and I fall to my knees in a silent crash. The Elmer Bernstein trumpets start back up in my head, a loop that drives me nuts. I bury my face in Annabeth's scratchy polyester comforter, and I slide down and droop over and melt into the floor, and I am suddenly looking at a metal box. I don't know this metal box. I pull it out from beneath her bed and I lift the box's cover. There is an orange and gray striped diary inside, and I hold it tight and feel that I cannot be here. I cannot do this in this room. I stand up and power walk across the hall to my room, which is precisely 300 times as hot as Annabeth's. We got our twin beds on the exact same day. They were actually a matching set. And so I recreate the scene back in my sister's room, and I lie on the floor next to my bed, and I open her diary to a random page. Dream schools, it says at the top. She has made a graph, which is so her. Under dream schools, she has listed 7 of them. She has written dream majors next to dream schools and created an orderly column. And her dream majors were communications and or Spanish. My sister's dream major was Spanish? She was dating Jeff, and her dream major was Spanish, and what else that I'll never know. Here's what she never said in her diary, because I'm flipping through it now so fast, the pages might start smoking and I wouldn't blink. She never said her dream major was cinema studies. She never said her dream major was filmmaking. She never said she wanted that. This genuinely surprises me. I page through in order to find something happier, and I do. I see the phrase, "Win is driving me effing nuts today," from like 2 years ago, and now I burst into tears. Happy tears. Happy to read a new truth from my sister. I never thought I'd get to hear a new truth from her. And then more. G says Wynn looked at him funny today and that he hopes when Wynn comes out to him, it's not as a confession that he's in love with him. And then, on another page, G didn't want to have sex. He said he didn't want it to throw off the dynamic between us. But I pushed and he relented and we had completely awkward and actually painful but kind of funny sex. And I want more. Mwahahaha. And I look at the wall like I'm in a sitcom. And I can't believe the straight-laced sister character just said that. I wait for the laugh track, but I'm still hearing only trumpets. I flip to another page, and it says, G is vaguely desperate for Wynn to apply to this film contest so he can be out of our hair this summer and we won't have to sneak around anymore. And I don't let myself register any of that, none of it, and instead I turn 5 pages ahead to find, G and I talked about breaking up when I go away to school, but it is hard to imagine meeting somebody who is as good of a fit for me. This is the only revelation that makes me mad, because you know who was the perfect fit for her? I was. People used to think we were twins, even. I close the box, and also my eyes, and I slide the box beneath my twin-sized bed, and it hits something with the very same clack that the photo of Amir and Evan made when my elbow went on a secret mission tonight to knock over their photo. I push Annabeth's box out of the way and squint, but it's endlessly dark beneath my bed, and so I reach my arm beneath it and feel around, and when I grab the thing that made the clack, it's as if I found the sword or the poison, one or the other, the weapon or elixir that is meant to send the hero of every screenplay home, reborn. Because there's no place, of course, like home. Except I'm already home. The trumpets in my head are now manic, blatting all over the place. Elmer Bernstein's arms sagging in exhaustion after conducting this insane orchestra, not of tiny people, but of huge ones, of demons, of Ricky and my father, and most of all of me. It's my old cell phone. I have found it. I pull it out from beneath my bed, and I shake the dust bunnies from my arm. And when I stand, the floors give and hum, and maybe I should have shut my door, because I'm making enough ruckus in here that when I sit on my bed and look at this black box recorder that holds Annabeth's final message to me like a dead girl's fist, Mom is just above the movie frame, in the doorway, looking at me like I am no longer a virgin. And just like that, the trumpets stop. Chapter 32. Hey, I text Jeff. Hey, morning, what's up, at work? You have a minute to talk? No, Quinn, I'm at work, some people work. Ha ha ha. Ha ha. Ha 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 ha. Ha ha ha. I'm standing in my backyard, right over the makeshift pit Dad and I used to make illegal fires in. It's basically overgrown now, so lush you have to dull out your eyes to see the charred-out, mossy cement blocks from before. Our backyard could really be something. We've got a lot of space. If I ever actually sell a screenplay, you can screw my Hollywood Hills backyard. I am buying a pool for Mom here. I just am. I found my old phone last night, I send. Okay. I plugged it in. Haven't turned it on yet. I want to say something else, though. Calling you in 5. And so he does. Exactly 5 minutes later, Jeff is the picture of punctuality now that he has a job. We're getting older so fast these days. It's fucking eerie. What's up? He goes. First off, I'm sorry that I freaked out on you last night and almost threw your mom's metal fruit at the wall in the basement. Sigh. Yep. And that I threw the acceptance letter thing at your face. I have such bad aim, usually. I'm waiting for him to snort laugh, but instead I hear a version of a cough happen on the other side of the phone, the same throaty thing he's done since I first saw him cry when we were 5 and I yanked the truck out of his hand and he wept so quietly that it was the day I learned that a person can make you feel guiltier by underreacting. I should, Jeff finally goes, and I say, go for it. And I hold my new phone to my ear for 1 second longer and hear him tell a customer to just take the drink and that he was sorry for being rude. I gotta stop forcing people to be rude on my behalf. Right before I hang up, Jeff comes back on and goes, Win? Yeah? I guess everybody's calling me Win now. Do you want to go to the pool with me and Carly this afternoon? I think she wants to apologize to you. You can bring your boyfriend. I pull a weed out from between 2 fire pit cinder blocks. The weed is pricklier than I'd anticipated, and it makes the cardboard cut on my hand scream like it's in a silent movie. No, I say. I think Amir and I are a past tense thing now. Oh, dude. But yes, I want to go to the pool so hard. Gimme 20 and I'm off work, Jeff goes. And I'm saying, hey, if I can't make it rain this summer, at least I'll get wet today. And it is such a cheesy piece of dialogue that I'm glad he's already hung up. When I'm back in my room a minute later, I slip on my old swim trunks, expecting them to be snug. Isn't every 17-year-old boy supposed to outgrow his clothes like every 2 weeks? But I'm so skinny, they practically pool at my feet. So I double knot them twice. And I unplug my old phone from the wall and throw it in my book bag. And as I head out, I touch Annabeth's door on the way to the stairs. Chapter 33. We are right in the middle of an annoying conversation about this movie contest in LA when, shit, Jeff says. He pulls his Corolla off the parkway without using the turn signal. What? I forgot I have to pick up Carly in Mount Lebo, he goes, and that cracks us both up. We almost forgot an entire other human on our way to the country club pool. I'm glad for the distraction, for the tonal shift, for the introduction of a B story, but Jeff picks the talk right back up. Seriously, if you don't do this writing lab thing, you're crazy. So I jump right back in too. How would my mom afford a ticket to L.A.? Where would I stay? Nothing about it makes sense. You could stay with Ricky Devlin, Jeff goes, and I roll my eyes hard enough that I bet he can hear the sockets creaking. We could find you a cheap flight. We have different definitions of a cheap flight, I say. In my family, a cheap flight is jumping off the roof and landing on a mattress. Jeff laughs. We used to actually do this together until he broke his ankle in 5th grade. And anyway, whatever. I'm worried he'll offer to pay for the flight, so I talk fast. This was written to be our movie together, not some rando director's in L.A. You're out of your mind, Jeff goes. She didn't even apply, Wynn. She would have been really, really happy for you to get out of her hair and meet a director who really wanted to be a director. He's doing the thing I hate where he steers with his knee. Just finish the damn screenplay and get over yourself. No, I would need a bigger sign. She was probably just humoring you. Annabeth never humor. Maybe she would have changed her mind about me going without her once I actually got in. And could you please use, like, one hand to drive? Just one? In some families, the guys do snap at each other. Jeez, Louise. Ignore. Talk quieter. I'd need a sign. Awkward pause, and then Jeff makes the tiniest girl voice and keeps his mouth still and squeaks out, "Win! I want you to go!" And I punch his arm and go, "That's not funny." And that's usually where we'd bust out laughing, but we don't. I reach into his glove compartment for a Jolly Rancher, but they're all gone. We're driving past the Presbyterian Church, and I shouldn't be surprised when we stop at a red light next to the Liberty, but I am because of what I see. Green light, and then, "Oh my God, stop," I say, and Jeff goes, "What? Why?" And I go, "Pull over," and I jump out before he stops. "Excuse me," I shout like a crazy person, dashing through the cars. I lose a flip-flop in the street, but I keep going, running to this blonde woman who is pulling down the "For Rent" sign outside the Liberty. "Excuse me, are you Jen?" I say. She sure looks like Jennifer Jen Reichardt, whose shiny, happy realtor face is still splattered across the building. "Rick?" she says weirdly. "No, no," I say, "I'm not. I'm Wynn. My name is Wynn. Anyway." "Dude, what are you doing?" Jeff has the Corolla double parked. He's got the passenger window rolled down and is kind of hollering at me. "One sec," I say, and whip my head back to Jen. "What's going on here?" "Somebody put in a bid on this place," she goes, crumpling the "For Rent" poster into her stomach. She looks tired but happy. "Wait, to, like, turn it back into..." But then I stop. I know the ending. I know the whole story already. My mind is blown open, and instead of brain splatter, what happens is 1,000 firecrackers burst out of my ears. "Dude, come on! Carly's texting me." "Thank you for not renting this out as a pharmacy or a bank," I say, and Jen goes, "Don't thank me, thank the buyer." I tear down a big handful of flyers from the ticket window, and then another, and I stuff them in a garbage can on the curb and get into G's Corolla. "Sorry," I say, flopping back into the car seat, "but that was the craziest thing ever. I think Ricky fucking Devlin might be buying the fucking Liberty." And Jeff steals my catchphrase and goes, "No way." And I steal Amir's and go, "Way." And as we take off again to pick up Carly, Jeff turns down the Song of the Summer, and I'm thinking he's going to nag me to buckle up, but instead he just goes, "Sounds like a sign to me." "Put it all on account 1980, Jeff says to the cashier, before we take our trays to find some shade. "Open question, can somebody be considered a cashier if they never actually deal with cash? Regardless, it's a fundamental universal law that there is nothing better than poolside corn dogs that somebody else's dad is funding." "You two gross me out eating those things, seriously," Carly goes, and Jeff and I stop chewing and we lock eyes and for 2 seconds almost make gross animal noises, but somehow we skip that today. Besides, I brought the rest of my ice cream cake to the pool and it's time for dessert. Today's the 6-month anniversary. We never miss a half birthday, though this is more of a half death day, I suppose. "Dude," Jeff says. He kicks my knee with a neon flip-flop. "You got half birthday cake on you." I pull up my tank top to lick it off. Jeff cackles. "I love a dude who fights for his chocolate," he goes. And even Carly lightens up a little and goes, "Chocolate is literally everything." And I look right at her for the first time today. Just when I think she's going to apologize for all the drama on Amir's boat last night, for spilled secrets that should never have been secrets to begin with, for being kind of mean, for stirring the pot and stirring my life, too, she doesn't. She goes, "Handstand contest?" instead, and I bust into giggles and go, "Duh," and she and I dump our trays and throw away the last piece of cake, and leave Jeff behind because he can't go upside down in the water. Makes him puke, always has, oddest thing. Not even 2 seconds later, I'm careening into the pool, chocolatey tank top and all, sunglasses and all, hat and all, one flip-flop only. And I'm upside down, pressing my hands into the bumpy bottom and feeling my skin pucker up cold and feeling like this is the first time in 6 months I haven't felt upside down, but rather exactly right. We pop to the surface maybe 30 seconds later. We haven't done this in years. I can't believe my stamina, though I also think she let me win. "You let me win," I go, but Carly is shaking her head. "You were down there for like 2 minutes. Seriously? It was freaking me out." Jeff is by the side of the pool, his hands on his hips. From this angle, I see that he is going to turn out genuinely cute someday. That sometimes I should let people just make up their own character descriptions. "I've been holding my breath for 6 months, I guess," I say, and even though it's a little jokey, all of my dialogue is, so sue me, I'd seriously like to hear your first draft jokes. We all smile at one another. I think at the same moment, we all picture how bad Annabeth was at handstands, how she used to come right back up, coughing right away, how she always lost. And just when that's the saddest little memory, because all the saddest memories are the small ones that creep up on you quiet and scary as a summer bug, Jeff does a cannonball right beside Carly and soaks her, and we all laugh and shriek. The lifeguard tells us to knock it the heck off, but it's a good moment, which is all you can count on or hope for, I think. Tiny little good moments that you catch like a firefly. And just like fireflies, you have to release them, because the whole point is that they're tiny and little and need to be with other fireflies. They aren't a pet. They aren't yours to keep. They're just moments. They're just fireflies. Chapter 34. Jeff takes me grocery shopping. It's supposed to be a quick little trip, but it turns into an epic voyage. We don't buy 6 bananas, we buy 12. We don't buy 5 apples, we buy 20. We buy healthy stuff. No more Cocoa Krispies. We take it all out to Jeff's car, and I'm eating a peach in the front seat, and it's dripping everywhere. And you see, this is the problem with fruit. It only seems portable and convenient. Turns out you need a hazmat suit and 6 towels to eat a peach. Guess what that's not true for? Pop-Tarts, Cheetos, I could go on. "Oh, crap," Jeff goes. "Here comes Dwight." I lean forward and look out the window, and even though we don't go to school with anyone named Dwight, I fall for it, and then the smell hits me. "Jesus Christ, Jeff," I say, and I lift my t-shirt and cover my nose. "Seriously, you should see a doctor." He rolls down the window and starts laughing so hard the Corolla swerves. My stomach does, too. "Seriously," I say, "you should be ashamed." I let an appropriate amount of time go by before dropping my collar, but Jesus, Dwight is still here, like an uncle at Thanksgiving whose stories last way too long and never have a punchline. "Seriously," I say again, but then I start laughing because the other choice is vomiting, and my stomach is having too good a time with the ice cream cake to say goodbye to it already. We pull into my rocky driveway. I'm thinking maybe we should whip up some lemonade for old time's sake, but I let the thought go. We unload all the groceries super quietly, because Mom is asleep in the sunroom, and then I walk G back out to the car, and I take a paper towel to wipe up some of the peach juice on the seat, and I swear to you, Dwight is still lingering in there like a nightmare fog, and it makes us laugh again. We make some vague plans for Jeff to come back in a couple hours with some tools to finally put in the new AC, and we're still laughing about that lingering Dwight. But before I let Jeff go, I stop laughing, and I pull my old phone out of my book bag, and I hold it up for him to see. Jeff looks at it weird, like it's an ancient Mesopotamian tool. "I thought, I don't know," I say. "I thought we could turn it back on together." Deep breath. "Jeff, I have to tell you something." deep exhale. Annabeth died right after sending me one last text. When? I know. Everybody knows. He puts his hand on my shoulder. Literally everybody knows. It was on the news. Ignore. Can't compute. I power the phone on, and my stomach does every single ride at Kennywood at once. The old cell takes forever to come awake, and in a flash I think that perhaps I'll be saved from reading the message from beyond. Jeff even goes, dude, maybe it won't even, like, register old texts, since you have a new phone now. When, ding, there's exactly 300 unread messages, but only one that matters. I can't look at it. I can't look at it. I hold it up for Jeff to see. He touches the screen and then his eyes go watery, but he is somehow made out of smiles. You're dead to me, I texted my sister, after not finishing the college recommendation letter for her teacher to sign, after almost 2 decades of not appreciating the A to my Q. And right before she ran the red light without her seatbelt on, she wrote, read it, dude, Jeff says. I flip the phone around. Grow up, Wynn, it says. Chapter 35. After Jeff drives off, I walk 2 steps at a time upstairs and I keep up the pace till I reach my desk, where I wake up my laptop and decide it is time to finally do it, to finish the damn screenplay. And here's the thing. I don't plan out the last 15 pages or refer to Ricky Devlin's outline or worry about satisfying mythical story beats. I just type. 40 minutes later, that's all a first stab at it took, 40 minutes, or maybe 6 months and 40 minutes, depending on your math. I hit print and pace an infinity loop in my floor until the hot stack of paper piles up, which I grab to take downstairs. When I wake up Mom, I am crying, and so she is too, immediately. What is it? Mom, I'm gay, I say, which I didn't expect to say, but there you have it. She holds my gaze. I know. I've known. Are you, like, disappointed? Her face fuzzes over like mine does when I write dialogue, or so my sister used to tell me. Only in myself, Mom says, that you'd think you could ever disappoint me. Her eyes well back up for round 2. I just want you to be happy, baby. She looks like my sister who cried at everything. But maybe you aren't a baby anymore. Did you know about Jeff and Annabeth? Of course, yes. Her voice changes gears. It grinds in the shift. It was killing me for you not to know. I don't like secrets. I take a pillowcase off her pillow. We don't have throw pillows. We have full-on pillow pillows in the sunroom to make up for how uncomfortable wicker furniture is. I walk the pillowcase to the mantel, and I throw it on top of the urn. I can't look at it anymore. It isn't good enough for Annabeth. It's fake. Well, that just makes it look like a ghost, Mom says, and she isn't wrong. It looks as if the urn is dressed up in a cheap ghost costume. That amazing Halloween sequence in E.T. Yeah, I go, but don't you always kind of feel like she's with us? Like, doesn't she feel like a ghost already? I believe in heaven, Mom says. Doesn't it feel like she's always over your shoulder, though? Every minute, Mom says. Every second. Now she practically laughs almost. Her sobbing is so hard, like a hyena or a volcano. She laughs, and I do too, because this is almost joyful. This realization that we get to share something again. Misery loves company, and that's not a bad thing, folks. Misery fucking needs company. I saw fruit in the fridge, Mom says curiously, as a middle schooler might if his parents had laid out a book about how bodies change. My parents never did that for me. Maybe that's why I was the last guy in my class to get armpit hair. My body just never knew the rules. Yeah, I say. I thought we'd have some fruit for once. The red ones are called apples and the purple ones are called grapes. Alert the authorities, she says, fast, and I tilt my head at her and she winks at me and I solve a riddle. I got my humor from her. I am hers. You never gave me my birthday gift, Mama, I say. I wipe my nose across my arm. Oh, it's being delivered this afternoon. Wait, what's being delivered? Your present. I've been saving up. I ordered you a replacement air conditioner, a really good one, too, a sturdy one. She takes a deep breath. My new goal is to cut up my credit cards and start paying for everything outright. Mom, I say, that is amazing. And it is, but I'm also thinking, I've got to call Jeff and tell him to just return the one we bought. And so I go, let me make a quick call, when Mom goes, well, fine, Winnie, but first you have to tell me what's in your hand. I look down. I'd forgotten about the whole reason I came downstairs. I did it, I say, and then I clear my throat and I look over at the urn ghost, and I don't flinch this time. I finished this screenplay thing I've been working on, or I mean that I haven't been working on. This is where my sister would ask me to read it for her. Read it to me, she'd say, no caveats. I hold up the new pages and scan the first lines of dialogue. Garbage. But still, I was thinking I could, I don't know, read it to me, Mom says, like a question that isn't one. Yeah, I mean, the last couple pages, anyway. I just wrote it, so it's probably going to be rough. So, don't move, Mom says. I'm going to need one of the red fruits. I'm going to need strength for this. And so she gets an apple. And she sits back down on the wicker lounger, and she settles in as if I am a movie. No, as if I am her son, who she just wants to be happy. And I clear my throat again and close my eyes and count backward from 10. Exterior, ordinary suburban house, day, I begin, and I read fast because I don't want to hear Mom not laugh at jokes that she doesn't realize are supposed to be jokes. That would crush me. When I get to the final clunky pieces of dialogue in the screenplay where my little protagonist, Double Digits, comes home from battle and discovers that everything is different, that his heroes are just ordinary mortals, and that his life has turned out both more heartbreaking and more astonishing than anything a movie could ever attempt to pull off, I am so overcome with grief that Annabeth isn't here to tell me how to make it better that I can't keep going. I actually drop the final page of the screenplay and my head, too. But then I hear Mom crunching and crunching on that apple. Nothing stops the Roberts family from eating. And when I look up to smile at that, at my beautiful mom crunching away, I also see out of the corner of my eye the pillowcase fall from the urn. It lands quietly on the floor. I leave it there and I pick up the last page and I finish what I started. Chapter 36. Interior, Quinn's bedroom, night. It's late. Quinn gets into bed and covers himself head to toe in a thick blanket. He switches off his bedside lamp. He takes out his earplugs. And then we hear what he hears, the pleasant drone of his brand new air conditioner humming from the window. The air conditioner is still wrapped in a big red ribbon like a car in a TV commercial. Quinn props himself up, takes off his fake glasses, and drops them into the wastebasket beside his bed. Then he lies back down and closes his eyes, and he smiles. Fade to black.
The Great American Whatever was written and read by Tim Federle. The recording engineers were Jamie Mattler and Charles de Montebello at CDM Studios in New York. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Great American Whatever was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Great American Whatever is available in print from Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Better Nate Than Ever and 567 Nate, both written and read by Tim Federle.
Hi, this is Tim Federle, author and narrator of the audiobook The Great American Whatever. The Great American Whatever is my first novel for teenagers, though, like my earlier work, it takes place in Pittsburgh, which is where I'm from. And this is a story of a 16-year-old student filmmaker who has to face this unexpected tragedy when his older sister, who's also his collaborator in filmmaking, is killed in a car accident. It also happens to be 6 months after that accident, which is the same week he meets a guy for the first time and has to kind of choose whether or not he's going to come out of his shell, come out of the closet, and grasp what future he might still have left. I was inspired to write YA, first of all, because I read a lot of YA, and also, this might just be me, but those teenage years were some of the hardest of my life, but they were also some of the most exciting. It's sort of when I decided I was going to move to New York and try to dance on Broadway, and in a lot of ways, I feel like there were still some things I needed to work out from the past. It was different than writing for middle schoolers, because I can say the F word, but also, more seriously, because you can plumb some of the depths and get really serious in a way that you sometimes have to skim the surface for younger readers. There's a number of authors whose work have really influenced me. One is David Levithan, of course, the celebrated YA author who's written a lot about LGBT stuff, but also he's just a great writer. You know, he's not a genre writer. He can write anything. I also have read some Anne Ursu, who writes great middle grade. I'm, of course, a huge fan of Rebecca Stead. And then there's some grown-up writers, like Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild. She also wrote this book called Tiny Beautiful Things, which is all nonfiction advice columns that were collected originally on a website called The Rumpus. And I've given a copy of that book to about 100 people. And then the book that got me writing is a book called Mindset by a Stanford psychologist named Carol Dweck, who talks about how you can either have a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. And the growth mindset says if you fall down, you got to get back up. And that book sort of convinced me it was time to start writing. Other than the standard hope that every author has, which is that you have one great reader or like a million great readers, is also really nice. And I think Great American Whatever is going to resonate with LGBTQ listeners, both teens and adults, because a lot of those listeners I already have with Better Nate Than Ever. There's a line in the book where Quinn, who's the narrator, says, you know, it seems like such a hassle to come out. I just want to be out. And that's how I felt. I was never guilty about being gay, but I definitely felt like, ugh, is this the day I have to like ruin dinner? P.S. My parents were totally cool with it. So I hope that readers of all persuasions find a really funny, wry narrator who also speaks to a minority population who will someday, I hope, realize about themselves that everything that gets them picked on as a kid is probably going to get them paid as an adult. So I'm hugely like Quinn, starting with the fact that my parents were going to name me Quinn. And then right before they had me, my dad was like, ugh, I don't, maybe he'll get made fun of if we name him Quinn. I took care of that. Still did it as a Tim. I'm like Quinn because I'm very sarcastic, but I'm actually really sensitive. I think sometimes people think I'm just like super snark, but actually I am totally moved by people being vulnerable and putting themselves out there. And I think that's a lot like Quinn. I'm also a Pittsburgher. I'm also gay. And very much like Quinn, this book was somewhat drawn from an experience I had in high school in which a girl at my school was killed in a car accident outside of school. And it was the first person I had ever known who died. She died before my grandparents died. She was this really special light of a girl who was in the theater department. And I never forgot her. And so I'm like Quinn in the sense that I think her life will inform my life for the rest of my life. Great American Whatever is somewhat different from the Nate audiobooks because Quinn speaks with a certain sophistication that I frankly think a lot of gay people have because we're so aware so early that we're different from others. So my experience was I became a great observer of humanity because when I wasn't commenting on it, I was avoiding it, like ducking under their fists. So what that means is Quinn speaks more like I do, and it's less filtered than middle grade, which means sometimes we go 2-3 pages at a time without me stumbling, which is a real pleasure as a narrator. I think what I love most about the recording process is I know I have an audience out there, and on a day like today, I've got an audience of 2, a director and an engineer, and I love knowing that people are hearing my words and responding in a way that I used to have as a performer when I was dancing on Broadway. The biggest challenge is you don't hear the laughs, you don't hear the sighs, you don't get applause, but you sometimes have to keep in your head the audience, but you also have to lose yourself in the world. And I'm sitting alone in a booth right now and facing a black wall, and it's a really cool job, but it's also you have to really suspend your own kind of disbelief and go, I am in this world, I'm in Pittsburgh, I'm 16 years old, and that's a challenge. When I decide about accents, I try not to go too far off my own voice. So Quinn is so first person that a lot of it's just my own voice. But otherwise, it's just little twists you put on stuff. One character is originally from Dallas, so he has a little bit of a lilt. But ultimately, what I've realized about listeners and readers alike is that they really make the leap with you if you're lucky. And you don't have to put too much of a spin. You just have to try to be really honest. I hope people are moved by this book. I really do. I also hope it might give them a different view into the creative process. Quinn sees the world through the template of screenplays. In other words, he's a writer, and so he sometimes sees the world through the lens of how he wishes it would go if it were a movie version of his life. And I hope people get some insight into what it's like to lose somebody, but also make the choice to reach and to reach for something better.